Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Sturgis.
Thank you.
Wow. This is the first time I've seen this film on the big screen. And when we were at the school yesterday, I was trying to convey to the students what it was like in the 1950s when the studios were coming up with new ways of showing films to try to keep people in the theaters. Remember that one? That's when television was first coming into the home. And they were seriously and rightfully worried about people staying home and watching TV instead of going to the movies. And so a lot of cinematic advances happened in that time, and one of them was CineScope, and there's this nice wide screen, and it created a new way of filmmaking. And when I was talking to the students yesterday, I mentioned how with this nice wide screen, you know, you can have action going on in multiple sides of the screen. And I was there was a scene here that I thought was a perfect example of that. And that's MacReady beat the snot out of Ernest Borgnine. And he's talking to Smith, and he's putting Smith in his place and saying, you know, you're the big man now, but all these, you don't go out and do these things yourself. You know, you've sent people to do it for you. Now they've all got something on you. And while he's doing that speech, Spencer Tracy is center screen, and he's talking to Smith, who's over there on screen right, and Hector, James Coburn, you know, sitting here in a chair like this.
Lee Marvin.
I always get the two mixed up. You know, is staring at MacReady. And as MacReady's giving his speech to Smith, and he's talking to Hector behind him, saying, you know, you've got something on him now. And you see Lee Marvin do this. He's staring at MacReady, and then he blinks, and he just turns his head a little bit, and now he's staring at Smith. And in just that little moment, and it's very subtle, and you actually have to turn your head from one side of the screen to the other to watch it. But in that little moment, you're starting to see the schism there. You know, I mean, the thrust of this film is this stranger comes into this town with a secret. And just by his presence, just by asking questions, just by digging into things that they thought they had long left buried, this town, these people that were tenuously held together by this tragedy, they start to split. And, you know, we see it towards the end of the film as people start to take sides, people take stands that they had never taken before. But I thought in that little moment, just that little eye motion of Lee Marvin as he shifts his focus from one to the other, you really start to see that schism. So I hope you all caught that. As I said at the introduction, Michael Sturgis and I are old friends. We met shortly after he moved here to Charlottesville. His dad was John Sturgis, the director of the film and many other fine films. And over the years, because of my own film background, we've had plenty of chances to talk about films. We'll try not to get too film geeky up here, and we'll try to turn the questions over to you. But when we were talking to the students yesterday, and they had a few questions about...
Are they here, by the way? Are you here? Hi, guys.
Hey, good to see you again. Actually, we can't see you at all.
by the way, just to let you know, David Small, you're here somewhere? David, their teacher? Stand up, David. Wait, there he is, way in the back. He was part of the discussion yesterday. They have only seen, about first 30 minutes of the film? So part of our discussion yesterday was, what do you think is going to happen? So I encourage you to talk about that and get involved, wherever you are up there. I don't really have a lot of John Sturges' Bad Day of Black Rock stories, to be honest with you. I wish I did. The one I do have, when I first saw this film, was about seventh grade or so, and I was at a school in Los Angeles, and my dad agreed. He really didn't like he would not be up here right now, I guarantee it. He didn't like to talk about his films, didn't like to point any spotlight on it, but I conned him into coming. One of our teachers wanted to show it at the school to my class, and he agreed to come. And the teacher arranged it and got a print of it and ran the print, and we're watching the movie. And I was really proud, because there's my dad, and he made this movie. And I'd never seen it before. Two things. I knew by that point he had made a lot of other films that I really, really liked, but to be honest with you, at that age, I thought it was the most boring movie I'd ever seen in my life. It just didn't catch me at all. I look at it now, and there are lots of things about the themes of people being damaged, the redemption, people having their lives, their choices narrowed down, but at the time it didn't mean anything to me. But after we saw the film, and then Dad started talking about it, somewhere in his comments he said, well, you know, it's really nice to see it this way, but you might want to see it in color. And I kind of turned and looked at the teacher, and we saw it in black and white. And so here's a man who went to a lot of trouble to make a movie and make it a certain way, and he spent the entire time being quiet because my teacher had gotten a black and white print instead of a color print. And so I think that kind of tells you a little bit about the guy. He was very modest. Some people would have stopped it right 2 minutes into it and said, hey, that's a color film. Don't even show it that way. So it didn't even bother him, and I was maybe the only one who noticed his comment on it.
That's a good story. We could sit up here and chat all day, but I'd actually be interested in hearing any questions from you. And we'll start with that gentleman right there. Let me repeat the question because we're recording a session today and we probably didn't catch you. But the question was about making this film about paranoia and torn loyalty in the middle of the McCarthy era.
David Small yesterday asked about his films being masculinity. And I think I didn't disagree with that, but I thought the way the term is used today, in the sense of machismo and macho and muscles, I would say this movie addresses the idea of masculinity in the sense of being true to yourself. I mentioned a little earlier the whole notion of being damaged. MacReady is damaged. And I think that when you see the movie and you go into the theater and you see the title Bad Day at Black Rock, I think you think you're talking about the moment of when the film's taking place. But in fact, what you're talking about is what happened before. And this is the outcome. This is actually the good day. This is the redemption part. I don't know if he, bear in mind at that time it was MGM and he was a contract player just like everybody else. So Spencer Tracy's last film was a contract player. Dori Sherry was the producer. I think Dori Sherry would be the person to ask, who's not here, of course, but if you asked him, he may or may not take that kind of a position. Certainly the studio, when they saw it, had to think, hey, you're talking about this maybe indirectly. I don't know, there are a lot of movies after that in the 50s that directly went after it. It wasn't until the 60s. So did he consciously do that? As far as say, hey, we got to make this as a message, maybe not. But I think it had more to do with the ideals. But it was that time, certainly. And they had friends. I mean, they had personal friends who, when they were 18 years old and been members of the Communist Party, maybe they still were, who knows. But they saw that all the freedoms were being abridged, and these are timely issues. And here was a case of where people were writing, in some cases ghostwriting, I don't think this particular movie, but ghostwriting under Dalton Trumbo is an example of a famous screenwriter who got blacklisted but still worked kind of on the side. That was going on right at that moment. So it was personal. It wasn't just a McCarthy in Washington, D.C., but also in Hollywood. People couldn't work because of their opinions.
Right. And also for the era, this film really deals squarely with racism. And I don't know another film from the era that addresses that issue so head-on as this one does. And, you know, what racism and what fear of the stranger does to people.
The other thing you have to get around, going back to the being a 13-year-old watching the movie, by that time, the town with the secret had been done so many times. I mean, you know, when you sat here, if you haven't seen this movie before, you thought, oh, here we go, the town with the secret, and blah, blah, blah. Bear in mind, at that moment, if you saw it, you were seeing it for the first time. I mean, think about a movie. There is no movie that had that kind of a drama. Somebody would show up, people would talk, something would happen, and you'd go off on a storyline. In this case, you butt against heads for really an uncomfortable and kind of boring amount of time. And again, as a 13-year-old, you look at it and go, where is this going? But as an adult, I increasingly get it. I understand you're looking at each one of these people and looking at the cancer inside of them and studying, you know, how far it's gone.
Something else I appreciate, especially now, seeing it for the first time on the big screen like this, is how the desert and how the town is also a character in the film. You know, the first establishing shot is this train coming out of nowhere, people standing up and looking, and we see this tiny little town that doesn't seem to be much bigger than this room. And, you know, we that wonderful helicopter shot, which is astonishing to see, again, from a film from that era, you know, with a train passing underneath. And it brings us in. We get in closer and closer and closer. And then through much of the film, you know, at the beginning of the film, everything's shot in long. We see several people on the screen at the same time. We see that long road to nowhere that goes off in one distance, and the railroad tracks that go to off in the distance. And then we get closer and closer to the people until, you know, their faces are dominating the screen. And then the narrative leaves the town and goes up into the mountains and then has to come back down into the town. And the camera is really, you know, it establishes a real sense of geography, and that motion, you know, coming into the town, going back up and coming back down, gives the environments that he lives in, really establishes it for us. And you remember Walter Brennan says, you know, you walk 10 yards out of this town and you're going to be dead. You walk out of frame and you're no longer in the story. It just gets closer and closer and closer. And I think it's just a fantastic use of the camera and of the environs as another character, an unspoken character in the film.
The class yesterday asked a question about, a broad question about what a director does, and I gave a broad, probably pretty sad answer to it. But watching it again, I haven't seen it in years, there's one scene, remember the scene where they're all at the railroad tracks, Robert Ryan, Ernest Borgnine, they're plotting what they're going to do. And I thought a directorial touch was the scene where Ernest Borgnine is going back and forth with Ryan, and Ryan's just standing there. Borgnine's moving around, and at one point, Borgnine is standing on the railroad track, and he starts doing kind of a tippy toe on the railroad track, a tightrope. And if you remember the scene, it's right at the moment where something gets decided. And at that moment, Borgnine isn't very good at walking on the tightrope, makes it about two or three steps, and then off he goes. And you shouldn't notice it. You shouldn't pay attention to it. But dramatically, it does have a little tip. So that's something that a director, and the actor, of course, but I think that's something the director would really be a part of, is making that moment happen. And if I can compliment my dad on almost anything of his films, if you look at something like The Great Escape, there's very little about it that's cinematic. There aren't a lot of fancy shots or fancy cutting together. He was an editor before he became a director. What he wanted you to do was come into this room and just seamlessly go right into what's happening and not call any attention to himself. And I think those little kinds of things, you add up enough of those, if you do it properly, it becomes a real world for you. And even though in some ways Bad Day at Black Rock is stagey, it's very theatrical, there's a proscenium, like the railroad tracks of the proscenium, and you go further into the town. After a while, the first half, I think the class saw it up to the point where Ernest Borgnine is hitting him with the Jeep, hitting the Jeep with the car. The second half kind of shifts gears and changes. So you really start going off of the Greek tragedy paradigm of being a play and start going into a more traditional film where people are chopping it up.
I'll take another question in a second. I just want to say when the fight scene started, Michael was sitting next to me, and he just whispered, and he says, "I love what happens with the screen door just before it happened." And I love watching this with an audience. I've seen it on TV before, but I love the fact that you all cheered when Spencer Tracy started defending himself, because we all wanted him to do it. And even though I knew it was going to happen, to hear everybody start clapping and applauding, I got really excited too.
Borgnine is very, I mean, he's piggy. I mean, you could almost put an apple in his mouth at that scene where he's up against a wall and he's snorting, literally. And so when he goes down like a luau. He just, you know, hits the ground. And, you know,
but,
fun to watch.
But really, he's amazingly physical. I mean, that was him.
Yep.
When he got flipped, that wasn't a stunt.
Yeah, they weren't stunts.
That was him. And of course, you know, Spencer Tracy's doing it with one hand. Borgnine, you know, had to help him. And then
had,
you know,
to hurt.
It had to hurt. So talk about getting into
your
role.
I'd be curious to hear from the class, if you don't mind, the other folks, but is there anybody up there who saw it the first 30 minutes and has a question now? Other than why are you here?
We talked yesterday, and you had some guesses about how the film was going to end. And now that you've seen how it ends, I'd like to hear your thoughts. Go ahead. Just to repeat, you thought it was uncharacteristic, or I guess you didn't completely buy that at the end of the film, this medal that he's come to deliver, he gives it to the town.
My shot at that would be, remember, he's damaged too. He's feeling sorry for himself. And the town has redeemed his purpose now. So I think in that sense, he's just passing that along. I don't know that really, to me, it doesn't matter where the actual medal goes. I think it's the notion that what the medal was all about should be passed along to the people who, remember, within that context, someone like Walter Brennan, when he takes a swing at Lee Marvin, if he misses him, you know, there are a lot of consequences there. So that was bravery. And there's more bravery, I think, if you're somebody coming from here, you know, way down here in terms of being afraid, bringing yourself back up. So I think if you use a medal as an indicator of bravery, I think maybe that's the handoff there.
The theme of the festival this year was aliens. What full was aliens, immigrants, strangers, and newcomers. And I had recommended, excuse me, getting over a cold, I'd recommended to Richard Herskowitz that we show this film, because I thought it fit the theme, you know, because I thought, okay, here's this stranger coming into town. But when talking about this with Michael, he pointed out something interesting to me, that MacReady is very much like the people in the town, you know, very much cut from the same cloth with his own damage and his own secrets that he's carrying. And that the real stranger might be the Japanese farmer. So again, I'd be curious to hear from the high school students, now that you've seen the whole film, if you have some further impressions or some questions about it. Somebody out there? Well, while you're thinking about that, a lot of people are, I know, intrigued by the idea that you grew up in Hollywood, and your dad was a director, and you know, you had famous people over for Sunday brunch.
They did. I happened to be there.
Yeah. Well, exactly. That's every time we've talked about that, you know, you've always said, well, yeah, you know, but everybody you knew was involved with film.
Right.
You know, it was just it was an industry town. It was no more remarkable than meeting somebody in Charlottesville who works at the university. Like, yeah, well, of course you work at the university. So can you talk a little bit about that? And
I don't think so.
Okay. Any other questions?
I mean, they're fascinating people, but I was telling the class yesterday, an awful lot of the business is very, I can't use another word, industrial. It's really it's a business. And so I don't want to pull down anybody who is an actor or famous, but yeah, when you get past the immediate glamour and everything else, they're very similar to you and me. Some of them are nice, some of them aren't nice. And surprisingly, a lot of the ones, like the people you see here, Robert Ryan, who played Reno Smith, was a very nice man. I can't, off the top of my head, think of people who were, you think they're nice, but they're not, but there were, and I don't want to name any names. My point of view was really that, in some ways, you probably should have, there are probably people out there who know John Sturges' films better than I do, maybe. I know it from a unique point of view, and I knew him. He was a remarkable guy. My dad was a very intelligent, kind of private person. His movies reflect things going on inside of him, but I don't know if he wasn't somebody who hung out in Hollywood. The brunches were not the Hollywood brunches. There were some people coming over and you had scrambled eggs and talked. They didn't sit around and talk about, David Small asked you yesterday, they didn't sit around and talk about films and this shot and whatever. They wouldn't be sitting here comparing stuff. They'd be talking about their pensions or the parking spot or all the stuff that everybody else talks about. So I think in a way, growing up in Hollywood was remarkably ordinary. Looking back on it now, those are remarkable people, and all the different ways in which they got there were remarkable, but I didn't find my childhood all that unique. And I wish I had a bunch of great stories for you, but I don't.
Well, it's, you know, it's very much, it's an industry town, as Michael said. And, you know, your friends, you know, you may happen to have famous friends. Michael just told me that his dad and Robert Wise were roommates,
right,
many years before. Mm-hmm. And I've always intrigued, when he lived in New York, Spencer Tracy was roommates with Jimmy Cagney and Pat O'Brien. Friends put them together, the three Irish guys, and they shared an apartment for a couple of years. And boy, I would just love to transport myself back there sometime and just kind of hang out with those guys. Do we have a question? Oh, there we go. Here's a question.
Yes.
Boy, those are.
I'll let you condense the question.
Those are excellent points. Is this the first time you've seen the film? Because those are good observations. First question was: were audiences aware at the time about Japanese American soldiers who were fighting in Italy. And although it's not stated, one can certainly infer that that's who MacCready was serving with, and that's where he may have learned the jiu-jitsu moves from Kokomo? Kumoko Jr. That's a wonderful point, and honestly, I've never even thought of that before. And the other question was, or the other observation was that this is really a Western, and that's certainly true. Other people have called this a noir Western, where if you substitute the train for a stagecoach, you know, it has all the trappings of a standard Western, but dealing with issues that were current at the time.
The part that makes that poignant for me, the Japanese-American part, is that at that time, I mean, paranoia can do profound things, and fear can do profound things, but here you had the moxie as a country to basically ask some people to go over here, because it would be too confusing over in the Pacific, so come on over here to Europe and fight on our behalf. But in the meantime, we're going to take a whole bunch of your family and put them in camps just in case they're not, you know, on our side. And I think the good thing about this film is it doesn't beat you over the head with that. It's just, it's there, it's stated. So to get to the core of the beginning of your question about did the public know that, I would guess they probably liked the idea that they didn't know that. And they'd kind of go, huh, you know, maybe when you're done with the movie, the movies I like are the ones that still make you think about it later on and it kind of percolates up. And you kind of go, well, wait a minute, how come the Japanese units, what's that all about? And somebody might say, well, that's because they fought in Europe. And it just, off it goes.
And as you pointed out, in case people didn't hear, although the story takes place in 1945, the film was released in 1955, which is the middle of the Korean War. So
End of the Korean War.
Yeah. The end of the Korean War. So an opportunity to talk again about our relations with Asian Americans. Let's go with the gentleman in the back first, and then we'll do you next. The question is about CinemaScope and how much the fact that this was a CinemaScope affected the whole look and feeling of the film and how this would be different if it weren't CinemaScope. And since the first time you saw it was black and white 16mm print.
Yeah. It is the first MGM film using CinemaScope. I've done a little bit of brushing up on the aspect ratio, and I think the idea originally was that somebody did a study and found that that aspect ratio was essentially what the human eye or combination of eyes took in. The purpose was to represent what you saw. What's ironic about it is that the film mechanism, how films really work, doesn't really make use of that at all. It cuts, it changes. So you're kind of, I think they discovered along the way, that's why you don't see as many CinemaScope films now, frankly, that you don't need to do that. Good cutting and good structuring makes that unnecessary. I think, I'd have to guess, but I think Dad used CinemaScope to start off the way you're talking about it, very wide and very broad. But there were times when, again, going back to that scene on the railroad tracks where they're all standing there, where instead of watching them, you're inside of them. You're one of the co-conspirators, in a way, of watching what's going on. You just don't know what's going to happen next. So you're maybe the least knowledgeable person about what's going to happen next, but you're a townsperson. And I think he used it that way. If he had the choice, would he use CinemaScope? If he could say, you know, which way should you do it? That's a good question. But I think he made it a Western because a lot of Westerns used that style. But it's a good question. He did a little bit. I'm sorry.
Did John Sturges talk with you, his process of picking films? We might want to talk a little bit about the transition from the studio.
He pretty much called me every time he was going to do a film and asked me if that was okay. he was contracted in MGM, so I think they probably said, this is what you're going to do. That was the ending of the studio system, and you know we don't know that now. We know a different system. System now are agencies and actors and packaging and projects, but at the time, if you ran the studio, you were going to direct, you're going to star in it, you might be filming something this week, and then you're going to be filming something next week. At the end of the 50s, particularly one man, Harold Mirisch, who worked, I forget where he worked, but he decided to create a company called the Mirisch Corporation. The next movie you're going to see today, if you stay, is West Side Story. That was Mirisch as well, The Apartment. I mean, lots of wonderful films were being made. I think Some Like a Hot was one of the very first ones. My dad was one of the partners of that company, and it was mostly designed with people like Robert Wise and Billy Wilder, people who were directors who also wanted to produce, not because they wanted to be a producer, but rather they wanted to do exactly what you're talking about, which is if they found something that was near and dear to them, they were going to be able to bring it to a studio and say, this is what I want to do. Probably the best example for my dad was The Great Escape, which was essentially a book by Paul Brickhill, and that book had to do with his account of what it was like in a concentration camp during World War II. From that point on, I think he wasn't the only one who made what became the movie. You get a lot of people involved, and if they get excited about it, then it's going to take off in directions you might not imagine. So I don't think when they started the project of Great Escape, they knew there was going to be a Steve McQueen motorcycle chase or any of the other parts of it. He was very projectized. He was very much involved with the next movie. If he had filmed a movie, made a movie, and then it was going to come out in a few months, because there's a big stagger between when you make a film and when it's actually released. By the time it's released, he'd be way off of that mentally. He'd go way off into something else. And I do remember one thing he told me. He would sleep like a baby when he was working on a film in the shooting process, even though it was the time where you can really kind of screw things up. But the minute he stopped shooting and then started going into editing, he'd start losing sleep, insomnia, et cetera, because at that point, he had made all the decisions he could make. The film was already there, now you've got to, this is what you have to work with. And I think that when you're talking about how people pick projects, the director, if nothing else, is going to be the one who has that vision from the moment it's a script to the moment it gets cut together. We were talking with the class yesterday about how things are shot out of continuity. I would imagine Bad Day at Black Rock probably was able to follow fairly continuously, but some of those things are shot in Lone Pine. Some of them are shot on the soundstage. I mean, by today's standards, you look at it and go, that's a backdrop. That's not the desert out there. But that's shot maybe a month and a half separate. So if you're walking into a building with a scene and on the inside of the scene you have to continue the emotions, it's really the director who has to look at that. And if you're Lee Marvin and you're a relatively young actor, what are you doing here has to match what you're doing there. So I think they have to be able to carry that over. And he had to pick something that was going to fit what he was able to do well. He became a big action director. I don't think this is a big action film, but he would then start making those choices. If I have any regret about his career, looking back, and he kind of voiced this as well, is that his films got so big that they lost the quality of what some of his earlier, smaller films. This is kind of the last film he makes. He makes, I think it's Gunfight at the OK Corral right after this. And from that point on, he gets into the really bigger films. And I think he regretted getting into such films that were so large that they kind of got gangly. They lost their personal touch. He made three with Spencer Tracy, The Old Man and the Sea, People Against O'Hara, and this one. He made The Great Escape, The Magnificent Seven, which is probably the most famous, with the exception of Great Escape, most famous of his films. Most of you, whether you know it or not, you've probably seen it, even if you just went through somebody's living room and saw it on TV. It's considered, I read this somewhere, that Magnificent Seven was considered the most watched film in the world, second only to The Wizard of Oz, which really amazed me, because it's shown all over the place. Often American Westerns are much more popular around the world than they are here, and also critically as well, but they're just plain popular, still shown in theaters right now. Gunfight at the OK Corral, Ice Station Zebra, Marooned, The Eagles Landed, McHugh, Joe Kidd, which was a Clint Eastwood film. I'm trying to think of some others. Earlier in his career, he made one movie that Sean and I were talking about yesterday. It was his first film called Mystery Street with Ricardo Montalban. Anybody remember Ricardo Montalban? Nice guy. Corinthian Leather, of course, is what people think of.
But, Corinthian Leather.
Very nice man. It was about forensics. It was about a Boston forensic expert. This was made in like 1946, but if you go back and look at that, I think you can get it on like Netflix. It's short like this movie, it's black and white, but it's a tight little thriller, and he uses his head and he uses forensics. It's CSI done how many years ago?
Well, we're running over time, so I'm gonna close with a question to you. Would you like us to show a John Sturges film again next year? Thank you. All right. Okay. They're giving us hand signals up there, so right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.